the language to become superfluous, right? It has to be the thing. We all know that, right? Say, oh, Shakespeare's language, it's all about language. What does that mean? What it means is that the language is the map. The language is the experience. It is thought in action. It is what's happening in the room. So it has to, on some level, be, your instrument has to be able to kind of allow that language to create something meaningful to happen. So that's where you got to start.
Hello and welcome to The State of Shakespeare. I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And today we're talking with Ben Steinfeld. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Garrett. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm great. I'm really thrilled to be here.
What brings you to the studio today?
You do, Garrett.
I do.
Yes, yes.
Indeed, I invited you here today to talk about...
We'll talk about Shakespeare, but specifically our production of Cymbeline that happened recently and maybe some things that were revealed about acting and Shakespeare in that process.
Well, let's hope. So the piece that you've elected to bring in today is from Cymbeline. Could you set the scene for us a little bit?
Sure. This is Act 2, Scene 2, and this is Iachimo, who I played in the production. And what we know is that he's made a bet with Posthumus immediately upon meeting him, as often happens in the case of Shakespeare. People say, hi, how are you? Hi, how are you? Let's immediately engage with something preposterous now, which is great. Small talk is not very prevalent in Shakespeare, is it? Just a quick sidebar, which is that so many times in contemporary plays, actors are responsible for generating the life of the scene outside of the line. Language, because contemporary playwrights are interested in the ways in which language don't represent authentic experience. And the nice thing about Shakespeare is that because your experience is fully bound up inside what you say, you don't have to do quite as much work outside of the text. But the text is complicated enough to require all of you to be with it, right? So anyway, we've made this bet, and the bet is that I can seduce and sleep with his wife. And he disagrees. So we make a big bet on that. And I go from Italy to England to see her. I pull an act on her where I try to pretend that he's sleeping around with a bunch of hookers in Italy and that he's unfaithful to her. And I suggest the best way to get back at him is to take a little revenge of our own in the bedroom. She doesn't buy it. She says, get the hell out of here. I improvise an apology. And I say, oh, by the way, I've got some very valuable stuff with me that I'd like you to take care of for the night while I'm here. Is that okay? She says, sure, I'll leave it in my bedchamber. And I say, it's going to be in a trunk. See you later. So she goes to sleep, and Iachimo, Jack, pops out of the box.
Jack in the box.
You got it.
And Jack says?
He says this, the crickets sing, and man's o'er-labored sense repairs itself by rest. Our Tarquin thus did softly press the rushes ere he waked the chastity he wounded. Cytherea, how bravely thou becom'st thy bed, fresh lily, and whiter than the sheets, that I might touch, but kiss, one kiss, rubies unparagoned, how dearly they do it, 'tis her breathing that perfumes the chamber thus. The flame of the taper bows toward her and would underpeep her lids to see the enclosed lights now canopied under these windows, white and azure, laced with blue of heaven's own tinct. But my design, to note the chamber, I will write all down. Such and such pictures, there the window, such the adornment of her bed, the arras, figures, why, such and such, and the contents of the story. Ah, but some natural notes about her body, above 10,000 meaner movables, would testify to enrich mine inventory. O sleep, thou ape of death, lie dull upon her, and be her sense but as a monument, thus in a chapel lying. Come off. Come off, as slippery as the Gordian knot was hard. 'Tis mine, and this will witness outwardly, as strongly as the conscience does within, to the matting of her lord. On her left breast a mole sank spotted like the crimson drops at the bottom of a cowslip. Here's a voucher stronger than ever law could make. This secret will force him to think I have picked the lock and ta'en the treasure of her honor. no more. To what end? Why should I write this down that's riveted, screwed to my memory? I have enough. To the trunk again, and shut the spring of it. Swift, swift, you dragons of the night, that dawning may bear the raven's eye. I lodge in fear, though this a heavenly angel. Hell is here. 1, 2, 3. Time. Time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Geez, it's awfully lengthy. Sorry about that.
It's a perfect length. It's awesome.
So, Jim, you have a few questions about...
Well, I was going to start with this one, which I thought was a good sort of general question, which is, if there is one teaching point that is suggested by this material, what is it?
Well, one of my main things, especially when you're talking about a long chunk of text where you speak by yourself, is you have to do what we call let each thing be what it is. Sometimes when you have an extended period of text, or it's something that's in a monologue book or something, you sort of think, oh, this is a monologue. But the person you're playing doesn't know they're about to do a monologue. Right? They have one idea, and then they have the next idea, and then they have the next idea, and then that might make them reflect on a kind of broader idea about the way the world works, and then as in this speech, they go, wait a minute, what the hell am I talking about? I've got to get back to the reason I'm in this scene, which is to make some notes about the bedroom so I can convince him that I was here.
Right.
So that's the thing that is of most interest to me foundationally acting-wise about this piece, is really letting each thing be what it is and letting each thing be a discovery.
Right. So, yeah, and it seems to me that the piece is, I mean, you can break it in a variety of ways, but he spends a lot of time talking about her in the beginning.
Yes.
And, you know, I think it's a debate as to whether he does kiss her or not.
Right.
There's a mid-stop there. But then he, like you said, he remembers himself somewhere around line 14. I have the numbers, you don't.
Right.
But then, and this is a line maybe we can talk about to begin with. It's one of the ones you pointed out, Garrett. Why such and such? During that section, he says such 5 times. And then line 17 ends in what is a possible Alexandrine with double Pyrrhic troche. And
where is that?
This would be starting with why such and such.
Mm-hmm.
Right there, yeah. And to me, one of the things that came, because he goes right after that line, he goes back to her.
Right.
And so it seems to me that he kind of gets bored with his plan, and he goes, yada, 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 but let's go look at this one again, because she's the one I'm really interested in.
Could be, yeah. I mean, he does say, at the beginning of that line, which is one of those things that suggests to me a discovery. So what we always try to do is to make sure that the breath, I mean, the word inspiration, I believe, means actually to breathe in, yeah? So we always try to inspire the next idea with breath. And in rehearsal, you might sometimes see us activating that a little bit more than is necessary. But what we're trying to do is to send the body the signal that this idea is actually being received, and then you can just speak it. Rather than doing lots of acting in and around the language, we try to receive the things we say and the things that our scene partners say from the same place that we're putting out from in terms of language. So he would not, in my opinion, would not have the thought that says, oh, wait a minute, why am I writing down what's in the room? I should write down the details about her actual physical body. He wouldn't have that thought if he hadn't started by going through all the different things that are in the room.
Right.
So Shakespeare is writing a thought process. And so part of what we're trying to figure out in rehearsal is, what is the thought process here? And how does that create to experience? And as you pointed out, there's also a lot of physical things that he's doing, things that are related to her body. So you want to make sure that the text that you're speaking lines up with a physical activity. So when you say, I will write all down, that's a good time to pull out the notebook, right?
It's Shakespeare telling you what to do as
right.
an actor.
We know that, as you guys know, all of those physical instructions rest here in the text, right? I think that Helena monologue you were playing me before from another program begins with, then I confess, here, on my knee.
Right.
Well, good opportunity to take a knee there.
Right.
And see what that gives you experientially, rather than just being like, oh, gee, people were just kneeling all the time in Shakespeare. I guess it's no big deal.
Right, it is. And it's like the opening of Hamlet, where he says, friends to this ground. Some might say he's on the ground.
Right. And it's amazing to me how many of my acting students are afraid to actually receive those gifts, because they're afraid that it's going to put them into some kind of uncreative space. Right. And it's not, you know, it's not organic or something. And typically all the organic stuff comes as a result of actually letting yourself do the map. It's not that there's nothing organic there. It's that there's touch points for the experience.
Yeah, and the text is your map. I mean, and you can go off map if you care to, or there's a lot of, I mean, the map is, there's a lot of different roads.
Remember, Shakespeare's telling us a lot of things, right? The room smells a certain way. It looks a certain way. The candle is bending in a certain kind of way, right? But these are all things that we know would not have necessarily been true of the actual performance space. So it's all contained in the language.
So how does your exploration and investigation of the text begin? What's the first step for you? Suppose that you had, there was once upon a time, this was brand new to you. How would you have approached it?
Well, the first thing that I like to do is to ask myself a kind of double question, which is at Fiasco, we talk a lot about events. So the first thing that I would want to know is, what is the event of this thing on two levels? One is the story level, right? What's the story of this scene? Okay, he's hiding in the thing, right? Let me just make sure I understand what the story I'm actually supposed to be telling is. I'm in a new space, I'm discovering her, I'm writing things down, I'm making a plan, right? What's the basic event? Then the even more important event is the human event. What's going on here on a human level? What kind of experience is the person I'm playing having in this room? And how can I make those things happen right away at the table through language, right? Not 2 weeks into rehearsal when we get on our feet, but right away. The next thing I would do is I would go through the speech and I would say, where are all the different thoughts, right? We're making sure that I'm not mushing things together or moving on to one thing without fully dealing with another thing. I would deal with some scansion, right? I would scan the piece, and I would try to find out, what does the scansion tell me about the experience? Because I think sometimes scansion gets locked into kind of English class mode, where it's like, oh, it's iambic pentameter. It's like, but what is our responsibility to that? What does that mean?
So talk about that for just a second, if you would, since we're on it. When you scan, what do you look for?
Well, as we know, most of the time, the speech has a natural rhythm, right? So what scansion tells you, which words matter to Shakespeare? Which ideas matter to Shakespeare? How do the parentheticals and the different ways in which the thought is broken up maintain some kind of rhythm that keeps you going through? It's also a very good tool for memorization, sidebar, which is it's a lot easier to memorize something that has rhythm, which is why we can learn songs fast and stuff like that. So there's that. That's what I'd be looking for. But I'm also looking for irregularities in the rhythm. I especially am a big fan of when the first syllable of a line is stressed. That tends to mean that there's something about the experience or about the sound of that word that's being embodied. Cicely Berry, who we worked with from the RSC, showed us an amazing example of this in that Ophelia speech, What a Noble Mind is Here O'erthrown. And as that speech goes on, there's the first word of one of the lines contains blasted with ecstasy. She's talking about how his nobility and his intelligence and his genius has now been blasted with this thing. And the rhythm goes totally out of joint there. When she describes a person whose life has gone completely off the rails. And so that's an amazing example of how Shakespearean rhythm is informing you about how the sound and experience of speaking that word is the embodiment of the thing, rather than looking around for it.
Is there an example in this speech?
There might be, yes. Well, I think perhaps the line bows toward her. So there's, as you pointed out, there's a lot of midline endings. One begins, in the middle of the line begins, 'Tis her breathing that perfumes the chamber thus. The flame of the taper, this normally list line would scan, bows toward her and would underpeep her lids. Bows toward her and would underpeep her lids. But I have chosen to say bows toward her as a way of saying something that is supposed to have, to be essentially king of itself or have nothing that it would rather do than stand up straight, is actually leaning towards her to try to get a look under her eyelids at the exact tint of blue that she's working with in there. So there's a sense that the choice to speak poetically, which is another thing we should talk about maybe, is actually dominating that image so that he goes out of himself for a second to say, this thing that is doing something it doesn't normally do. So the rhythm of my speech is doing something it doesn't normally do too. To show you that she is capable of breaking through boundaries even of iambic pentameter. I mean, my God, how amazing is she, right? Is that making sense?
It makes sense, but let's investigate that a little bit further.
Yeah.
If the measure in question, if the beat in question, the foot,
right.
I should say, let me restart this question. If the foot in question consists of two monosyllables, bows toward, what suggests to you that the stress falls on the word bows?
Well, if the word is, right, or I'm making this up, or if it said the flame of the taper, I would say moves toward her. Right, because moves is not a word, or is toward her or something. Those are words that don't have the same plosives, the same kind of athleticism or physicality that Bowes does. Bowes has in it a specific choice that I feel like Shakespeare is making there that wants to draw. I think he's trying to draw my ear to something. So that's why. The game that I sometimes play with myself and with my students is to have them read the first word of every verse line down in a row and see what they learn from that, right? And then to read the last word of every line down in a column and see what they learn from that. And what you tend to find out is that the first words are things like this. This is in order. Did, the, how, and, but, how, right? There's very little information being offered there. But the same last words of those same lines are wakened, Cytherea, lily, touch, unparagoned, that, taper, right? So what this tells us is a couple of different things. One is that Shakespeare really puts most of the content in the stressed part of the line, but also in the back part of the line, so that your vocal energy and intellectual energy and thinking energy and caring energy has to keep moving through those ideas. However, when you encounter in the first position of the line a word that actually has content, like perfumes or bows, that suggests to me an experience that's being carried either in a very specific way or that Shakespeare is asking the ear to play in a different way, the way he does when he chooses to rhyme. Do you know what I mean by that?
I hope I do. But perhaps you'd like to clarify.
What I mean is that rhyme, like any other, well, now, when I'm going to put this all under the heading of choosing to speak poetically, talk about this all the time in our rehearsals and also with our students and with my students at Gallatin, which is that the person you're playing has to be the one choosing to speak this way. Right? You can't operate on Shakespeare's language and try to do something in a Shakespearean way. The person you're playing is the human being that has the capability of speaking this way. So what you have to figure out a way to do is how to choose to speak poetically when the time comes. Sometimes you're not choosing to speak poetically. Sometimes you're choosing to speak very simply. For example, but my design, to note the chamber, I will write all down. Couldn't be simpler. Something like, the flame of the taper bows toward her and would underpeep her lids to see the enclosed lights, now canopied under these windows, white and azure laced with blue of heaven's own tinct, is a deeply poetic idea. He doesn't just say she has really nice eyes, right? So you have to make sure that your acting is going into not necessarily a different way of being or thinking, but you have to understand that the experience that the person you're playing is having has changed, has leapt into a mode where they're choosing to operate in a much more engaged way. The same thing is true of rhyming, right? So a lot of speeches, you know, end with a rhymed couplet, or there's plays like Midsummer or Romeo and Juliet or Richard II or something that have huge chunks of the play that are fully rhymed all the time. You go, well, how can we make that a human thing? Well, these people who you are playing have the skill to do that, and they're choosing to do it for a certain reason, and the reason is so that you'll experience them in a specific way, so that you'll hear what they have to say in a specific way.
Well, let's explore this concept of modes even further.
Yeah.
So when you talk about speaking poetically,
right,
as opposed to speaking straightforwardly,
mm-hmm,
that is something that you intuit as a listener and as a performer. But what are the clues in the text that tell you this is poetic speech?
Well, all the things that we know from poetry, metaphor, imagery, similes, alliteration, assonance, right? Those are the clues that something is going on. So you have to, but again, these aren't English class clues because they're not poetic for the sake of being poetic. They're about an experience. So we have to figure out, how are these things, why is the person that I'm playing choosing to do this? There's a line when Iachimo is about to make his move on Imogen to say, let's go to bed together and make this right. When he says, should he, if, in other words, he's saying about to Imogen, about Posthumus, should he make me live like Diana's priest betwixt cold sheets, whilst he is vaulting variable ramps in your despite upon your purse, revenge it, right? So there's that double V there, which is in and of itself a kind of sensuous sound, yes? You, part of it is just giving yourself a chance to experience these things out loud, because you can only do so much with the kind of pen and the analytical stuff. So to your question, which is, what are the clues? A lot of those clues come from sound, from vibration, which is why it's so important to have an open, supple voice and breath happening early on in the process at the table, so that you can actually receive some signals from the language that go beyond your ability to kind of go, oh, look, there's a little bit of assonance.
That brings another question, and this gets to your process. What sort of things do you do to maintain your vocal instrument?
Well, we warm up before every rehearsal. So we have a warm-up that is based on what we learned in graduate school, which I believe was developed by Chuck Jones, And then there's some Edith Skinner speech work that we do, just basic, you know, warm-up stuff. But what I've come to realize is that the warm-up has to actually be you warming up yourself. So even though we all may be doing it collectively to kind of build an ensemble energy, you have to make sure that you're actually warming up your actual instrument and doing the things that you actually need to do. The biggest thing for me is warming up the breath. I actually, you know, Garrett, I know you sing quite beautifully and stuff. So you know that the breath that you take in is actually just as important as the thing that gets put out in terms of sound. But I feel like so often when you're warming up, it's like, I'm going to warm up my chest resonator. I'm going to warm up my mask resonance or something. I'm going to warm up my tongue tension or whatever. And so it all becomes about like how much you're putting out. So I try to use the warm up to actually do the opposite in some ways, which is to say, okay, good, I'm vibrating in the right ways. Now I need to really work on letting the breath all the way in. Do the other 50% of acting, which is the stuff that you receive. And the reason that we believe this so much about the voice is that you can't receive your own work. You can't get any of the benefits of your own acting if you're not actually open to what you've just said. That's why this inspiration breath is so important. So you can actually get something from what you're putting out instead of like putting out one thing, then I gotta put out the next thing, then I gotta make this thing happen. Right. Sometimes you are making things happen in a scene, and sometimes you have to allow them to happen. So that's what our process is, both vocally and acting-wise, at the table early on. For us, there is no separation between our vocal technique and our acting technique. There is no separation between our acting technique and our rehearsal technique. All of these are what we do all the time.
Fascinating.
One of our touchstone questions on the State of Shakespeare this season is, are you a versist or a punctuationist?
Well, those words were recently defined for me, and I think I have a basic understanding of what they are. I guess I would say that Fiasco and I live much more in the punctuation world, that we really tend to, when we're rehearsing, we tend to try to breathe at our punctuation. We use that as the thing that kind of helps us determine where thoughts are beginning and ending. We are not strict about taking a breath at the end of each verse line for the sake of I don't know what. And so the reason that we prefer that is that the questions you always have to ask when you're talking about technique are, what does it do for the actor? What does it do for the audience? What does it do for your experience? So our goal is to try to figure out, how is this person using language to manifest their experience? And we've found that breathing at the end of every verse line doesn't always let you do that. So we prefer to use our punctuation as a kind of guide to figuring out how to divide up thinking and use that as breath. And also, you should really just breathe when you need to. There's no point in torturing yourself because you think that's what the rules are. You know? The rules are only valuable if they give you something for your acting.
It also sounds like you're a person who goes for the thought.
As opposed to what?
As opposed to, right, exactly.
Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, well, what else is there? I think that's what drives people nuts with Shakespeare, is they kind of feel like they're supposed to be looking for, like, you know, treat it like Kabbalah text or something. There's all these kind of clues here. And there are. But those clues are for actors. They're not sort of for some thing, some idea that you're supposed to be responsible to. They're for your responsibility towards trying to have an amazing experience.
So for an actor who is interested in this sort of aesthetic and would like to do this kind of work, where can they get this sort of training?
Well, they can get it with us, luckily. Fiasco came up a couple years ago with something that we've called the Free Training Initiative. Because we realized a couple of things. One is, lots of people are interested in learning how to work this way, and they don't know how. And the other thing is that none of us, perhaps even the people at this table included, can really afford to pay for acting classes. And the other thing is that typically what you're paying for in an acting class is the result it's going to have for your career. So whether or not you're going to one of these sort of networking things, or you're taking a class with an old legend or whatever it is, everyone's always kind of consciously or unconsciously going, well, this can only be an investment in my career if it's going to have some kind of results for my career. Luckily, we've made it very clear to everyone that we can't do anything for your career. But, except maybe teach you how to act better, which might help you get more work. But what we can do is say, if you're willing to pledge your commitment and your artistry to us, we'll give you this training for free.
For more information about the Fiasco Theater Company and the Free Training Initiative, people should go to
www.fiascotheater.com, fiascotheater.com, and you can get all kinds of information about what we're up to there.
Thanks so much, Ben. Thanks for being here today on the State of Shakespeare.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Garrett. This was a real thrill.
I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
Thank you for listening. Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.